So it is so fun to be able to talk about Parshat Vayetze with everybody. It's one of the great parshiot in the Torah. And the particular part of the parsha that I wanted to focus on is this moment of betrayal. So if we look over here in source number one in Bereishit Perek Chaf Tet, chapter 29, we're told Vayavod Yaakov beRachel 7 shanim. Yaakov works in order to be able to marry Rachel for 7 years. Vayu ve'enav kiyamim achadim ba'avato ota. But he loves Rachel so much that even though he is working for 7 years, the time goes by very quickly. It doesn't, he's so excited to be able to marry her that it feels to him like just a few days. In verse 21, we're told, Vayomer Yaakov el Lavan, Hava et ishti ki malu yamai. The 7 years go by. When they're over, Yaakov says to Rachel's father, Lavan, give me my wife because the term of my labor has come to a close. Va'avoy, I will come to her. Some of the Parshanim are very concerned. They think this is kind of a crude way for Yaakov to speak, but they say he was just so excited to finally be married to Rachel, he didn't want to wait even another moment. And then in Pasuk Chafet, we're told, Vayasof Lavan et kol anshei ha-makom vayas mishteh. So sure enough, Lavan plans a wedding. He gathers all the people of his place. He makes a big party. Vayihi va'erev, vayikach et Leah vito, vayaveh ota elav, vayavo elaha. And then at night, instead of taking his daughter Rachel, instead he takes his other daughter Leah and brings her to Yaakov, and Yaakov is with her. And then we're told, then in Pasuk Chaftala, we're told, Vayitein Lavan la'atzil pashivchato le'leah vito shivcha. Lavan also gives his daughter, I guess, a wedding present of sorts. He gives her a maidservant named Zilpah. And then in Pasuk Chaf Hey, this is our big moment of drama. We're told, Vayihi vaboker vihinei hileah. In the morning, suddenly Yaakov realizes that the woman in bed with him is in fact Leah. And interestingly, the pasuk doesn't tell us what Yaakov says to Leah, right? We don't hear his reaction to Leah, but we hear him going to Lavan and saying to Lavan, "Mazot asitali? What is this that you've done to me? Halo v'Rachel avadati imach? Have I not worked for you for 7 years in order to marry Rachel? V'lama rimitani? Why have you deceived me and married me to Leah?" And Lavan's response is kind of interesting. He says, Lo yeah sechin bimkomenu latet hatzi'ira lifnei habechira. Lavan is not at all apologetic. He says, "Well, what do you think? That's not the way we do things in our place. We don't give the younger daughter before the older daughter. Obviously, I wasn't going to let you marry Rachel first. Obviously, Leah had to get married first instead." I think a couple of dynamics kind of emerge from these psukim, right? One is there's a sense that Yaakov is outraged, right? He really feels like he's been wronged by Lavan. And I think there's also a sense that there's something kind of humiliating about it, right? You know, he had this very intimate, intense experience. He thought he was with his intended wife, Rachel. In the morning, it turns out that he's been with another person. He's very upset about it. And Lavan seems totally nonplussed, right? Lavan is not sympathetic. He just says, "Yeah, what were you thinking? Obviously, this is the way it was going to go. In our place, we don't give the younger before the older." And it seems also like what Lavan is saying is not just, you know, I wasn't going to let you marry my younger daughter before my older daughter was married, but it almost seems like it's also kind of a jab at Yaakov, right? Maybe Yaakov, maybe where you come from, the younger one usurps the position of the older one, right? Because we know that when Yaakov first got to Lavan, he tells him what has happened to him. So presumably Yaakov has told Lavan about how he stole his older brother Esau's blessing, and Esau was so angry at him, and that's why he's on the run. So Lavan is saying, "Look, maybe where you come from, you think it's okay for the younger one to take the place of the older one, and that's why you tricked your father into giving you your older brother's blessing, but that's not the way we do things here." In terms of one aspect of the dynamic, right, Yaakov is sort of outraged. Lavan seems to think this is totally reasonable. But I think another aspect of it is it seems that, you know, we know that we're told that Yaakov loves Rachel when he sees her. We know that he works for her for 7 years, and he's so excited to marry her that he doesn't even mind working those 7 years. And given that he's kind of been in the same household as Rachel for 7 years and he's loved her the whole time, I think one question that the story kind of raises is, how did this trickery even happen, right? How is it possible that he didn't know that this was Leah in bed with him, right? How could he not have known that? And what we're going to see is that there are going to be several different attempts to explain how this could be, right? We understand that it's very embarrassing for Yaakov in the morning to realize that he was tricked, but how could this trickery even have happened? So if we look at the second source over here on the page, this is Radak. Radak says, "Vayhi baboker bihinehi Leah." In the morning, behold, she was Leah. Mikra ze milamdenu tzniuto shel Yaakov. Radak says, what we learn from this verse is how very modest Yaakov was. Shelo riba dvarim afilu imishto. Yaakov was very modest. He didn't speak very much. And he didn't even speak very much, certainly he didn't speak with other women. He didn't even speak with his intended wife. She ilu diberima haya makira bekol. Because if he had spoken to her really almost at all, he would have known her voice. And if he had known her voice, shehare kvar darima sheva shanim, he's been living with her in the same household for 7 years. If he had known her voice, then there's no way that, that he could have been tricked in this manner. He would, of course, heard her speaking with him and known that it was Rachel and not Leah. Sorry, he would have known that it was Leah and not Rachel. And so therefore it must be that he was so very modest. He didn't really speak very much, couldn't even recognize her voice, and that is how the trickery happened. So one possible way to understand the trickery is that it somehow speaks to Yaakov's extreme modesty. Either he didn't speak with Rachel very much during the 7 years that he was living with her, or at night when he was intimate with her, he didn't speak with her very much, and that's why he didn't recognize her voice. But Radak is saying there's something unusual going on here. Normally, we would have expected Yaakov to know that it was Leah, not Rachel, and it must just be a sign of something special about Yaakov, some extreme measure of modesty that he then doesn't realize that it is Leah with him. So that's one possibility. The other possibility, right? So one possibility is that it's something to do with Yaakov. Something about Yaakov makes it so that he doesn't know that it is Leah and not Rachel. The other possibility, which I think is a little bit more interesting to me, is that it's not really about Yaakov at all. There's something about Rachel, right? That basically this trickery could not have happened if Rachel was somehow not a part of it, right? That somehow Rachel needs to be complicit in it in order for the trickery to have happened and to have been successful. And if Rachel wasn't a part of it, there's no way that the ruse could have been pulled off. So if we look at source number three, there's a line over here in the Midrash in Esther Rabbah that I've always found very evocative. We're told, Rachel tafsa pelech shtika. Rachel grasped the art of silence, right? It's not just that she didn't happen to say something, but there was an artfulness to her silence. She grasped the art of silence. Ra'ata sivlonoteha biyad achota. She saw all of her bridal gifts being given to her sister, vishatka, and she was silent. And I think what the Midrash is saying is that it's not that Rachel couldn't do anything about it, right? You could imagine that maybe in a patriarchal society, maybe partly what's going on is that Rachel is, you know, she just doesn't have any power. Her father wants to marry off her sister instead of her. What can she do about it? She has to go along with it. But the Midrash says, no, it wasn't just that she couldn't do something about it. She could have done something about it, and she chose not to. She chose to kind of grasp this art of silence. She knew what was up. She knew that her father had this plan. She could tell that her sister was being prepared as the bride instead of her. And she was clever enough or artful enough to somehow remain silent. And the Midrash here doesn't talk about it yet, but the question is why, right? Why would she want to remain silent? In theory, she's supposed to be marrying Yaakov. Why is she going along with her father's plan? And we'll see kind of different answers to that. But if we look here at source number four, this is in the Talmud Bavli. We're told in Masachet Megillah, "Bischar tzniut shehayta ba beRachel zachta v'yatza mimena Shaul." So Rachel is very, very modest. And because of her modesty, she merits having Shaul, the first king of Israel, as her descendant. Uvischar tzniut shehaya bo b'Shaul. And in in merit of the extreme modesty that Shaul had, zacha v'yatzat mimenu Esther. Actually, I want to make sure that you guys can also see the translation. It's hard to put them on this page at the same time. Sorry about that. But I will translate it as I go. And in a moment, I'll see the translation as well. So, okay. So in the merit of Rachel's modesty, she merits having Shaul, the first king of Israel, as her descendant. And then Shaul shares the same quality of modesty as his ancestor Rachel. And Shaul's reward is that he has Esther, the queen, as his descendant. Umaitniu taitaba beRachel. What was the modesty that Rachel had? And as part of the answer, the Gemara now kind of retells the story of the meeting up of Yaakov and Rachel. So Yaakov meets Rachel at the well when he first gets to her town. And as soon as he sees her, he loves her. And he says to her, Minsabali, will you marry me? Even though he's just met her. And she says, "In, yeah, I'll marry you. Mihu Abba Ramahu." She says, "But you should know my father is a deceiver. He's a tricky guy. Velo yachaltle, and you are not going to be able to best him." Right? He is somehow right. "I'm happy to marry you," she says, "but my father's really not going to let the marriage go through. He's very tricky, and I don't think that you're going to be able to match him in his trickery." Yaakov says, no, don't worry about it. Achiv ana beramaut. I am his brother in trickery. As tricky as he is, I can be just as tricky. And Rachel now says, kind of innocently, Umi sharia litzadike lisaguye biramuta. Is it permissible for righteous people to engage in trickery? Right? Which is a great question for her to ask, right? Yaakov, you seem like a pious, righteous person. Like, how can you be my father's brother in trickery? Are righteous people allowed to engage in trickery? Now, it's a very loaded question, right? Because if we remember, the reason why Yaakov finds himself at the well in Rachel's hometown is because he's on the run from his brother who wants to kill him, because Yaakov has, in fact, just engaged in a pretty terrible act of trickery. But she seems kind of surprised, right? Is it permissible for righteous people to engage in trickery? And he says to her, "In, yes, it is." And he quotes a pasuk from Shmuel Bet, "Im navar titavar, v'imikesh titapal." With people who are pure and righteous, you should behave in a righteous manner. But with people who are crooked, you should behave in a crooked manner. And so, therefore, if your father is crooked, it will be permitted for me to behave in a crooked manner as well. And I would say even this part of the story is kind of loaded also, right? Because it's one thing to be crooked in a response to a crooked person like Lavan, but the person who Yaakov has just tricked is his father, Yitzhak, who is not at all crooked, right? So it doesn't, right, even, you know, using this kind of reasoning of like, well, you know, you can be crooked if the other person is crooked, doesn't really explain his first act of trickery. But he says, you know, when it comes to your father, if he is a trickster, I can match him. And so now Yaakov begins to ask Rachel, "Umay Ramayuta, what is the nature, do you think, of this trickery that your father will engage in to prevent me from marrying you?" And Rachel immediately answers, "Itli achta dikshisha minai. I have a sister who's older than I am. Vilo min sabli mikama. He will not really allow me to get married before she gets married." So we're told, masar la simani. So Yaakov now gives her some signs. So that way he will be able to know that it is Rachel and not Leah. Ki mita lele. But when the wedding night came, Rachel said to herself, hashta mikasfa achtai. My sister will now be really humiliated, right, if she is kind of thrown out of bed on her wedding night. And I don't want that to happen. So misartinhu nihala. She gave those signs that Yaakov gave her to Leah. V'hainu dichtiv, and that is why the verse says, v'ihiva boker v'hine lihi Leah. In the morning, behold, it was Leah. Here, let me get to a little bit of the translation, at least for people who want it. Michlal da'ad hashta lav Leahi. Does that mean that until the morning it wasn't Leah? Of course it was Leah the whole time. Ella, mitoch simanim shemasra Rachel le'Leah, lo havaya da'ad hashta. Rather, because of the signs that Rachel gave to Leah, Yaakov didn't know that it was Leah until the morning. Okay, so I'm going to stop the share for one moment, because the question that I'm interested in asking everybody is, this is a pretty famous Gemara, this idea that Yaakov has given signs to Rachel that will allow him to know that it's Rachel and not Leah, and that she gives these signs over to Leah. But I'm just curious, when people think about this, what do you imagine the signs being, right? What do you think? What are these signs that Yaakov would be giving Rachel to help distinguish her?
Could be conversational lines. You say on a wedding night, you will say this to me, and therefore I will know that you are you're really Rachel.
Great, exactly. So Shelley says maybe it's some sort of code word, right? When I say this to you, you say this to me, and that way I will know for sure. Okay, and somebody else is suggesting that maybe it's like some sort of special handshake, right, that like we'll let them know. Okay, any other thoughts, right? What are these simanim, do we think, that he's, what are these signs that he's giving her?
A garment.
Some sort of garment, you're saying?
Yes, or a garment, yes. Like yeah. They did in another story, like with Tamar and with Tamar and Yehuda, like that idea.
Exactly, right? Tamar asks for Yehuda's like signs of identification. So maybe what Yaakov gives her is some sort of thing that will kind of some sort of garment or some sort of sign of identity. And Debbie here is suggesting that maybe it's some sort of umpire sign, right? All these things could be. Now, the thing that is strange about it, right, is that if you know somebody, then like, what does it mean to have a code word, right? You would just say like, hey, is it you? And you would hear their answer and you would, right? I assume that with my husband, Mike, right, he would know it was me just by talking to me, right? There wouldn't need to be any sort of like, other sign other than like, hey, you know, any, right, any sentence or two would be enough, right? If you know a person well, right, you can always tell who they are. So there's something like a little bit odd about this idea of a sign that he's giving her, right? Like it seems like, you know, it seems to sort of almost assume that like he wouldn't know her otherwise, right, unless he gives her some sort of sign. And the idea of the sign being transferable also seems kind of weird, right? Like something that he would be able to tell about her in the dark, I guess, that like she could transfer to somebody else that then the other person would know. There's something about it that does seem kind of odd. One other layer to this that I think is kind of interesting, for people who have ever studied either the Mishnah or the Gemara in Baba Metzia, there's this very interesting discussion in the second chapter of what happens if a person loses an object, right? If you lose an object and somebody else finds it, in order to sort of claim your object, you have to sort of give simanim, right? You have to be able to describe something about the object and then we can tell that it really belongs to you. So simanim are usually like something that a person who owns something is able to sort of recite about something else as a way of saying that they really know it. But it's a little bit strange to imagine then like that kind of knowledge being given over, right? I'm going to give you simanim so that way I'll really know that it's you. Okay. And yes.
Another point, ma'am, please. Yeah. There's one other point. If Rachel was a little bit worried, then it's actually very nice and very kind of Jacob to give her a sign so that she'll have some reassurance that everything will be able to go well.
Mm-hmm. So I think that's a really interesting way to put it, right? If she was worried, I like that because it feels to me like in this conversation, if I had to just like isolate the tone in the conversation that we just saw in the Gemara, it feels to me almost like she's more resigned than worried, right? He says to her, will you marry me? She says, sure, but I don't think it's going to happen because my father is a trickster. And Yaakov says, no, don't worry. I can handle it, right? And I guess she could be worried. I think Rachel's frame of mind is very interesting to me here in the story, right? What is she expecting to happen? and like, what is, how does she feel about it? It's really interesting. So I like that you're suggesting that, yeah, maybe she's really worried about it, right? If we assume that she really wants to marry Yaakov also, but she feels like there's just no way to do it because her father is going to get in the way somehow, then yeah, then I guess Yaakov would be sort of reassuring her that like, no, don't worry, I'm going to figure this out. Except actually what we find out is that it's really in Rachel's control, right? Because by, right, whatever we imagine the siman is, it's something that Yaakov is giving to Rachel that she's going to then give back to him so that he can identify her, which means that the way that they're setting it up is that he's relying on her to be able to make herself known, right? That's what it means, right? In order for the identification to happen because he's giving her simanim, what that means is somehow she's going to display these simanim or give them back to him, and then he'll know that it's her. And that means that he's trusting her, right? He's saying like, I'm assuming that you want to be with me as much as I want to be with you. And so therefore, together we can thwart your father, right? I'm going to give you something that you will then give back to me, and then I'll know for sure that it is you.
Isn't it possible that Rachel knew all along that her father was going to marry both of them off to Yaakov, and she knew that? What she didn't know was how it was going to affect her, how jealous that she would be, but that could be because she did not have a child. If she'd had a child right away, maybe she wouldn't have been so upset, and it would have been all fine with her. She expected this.
Yeah, so you know, Shelley, that's really interesting. I would say that in almost every description that I've seen, I mean, we'll see this, you know, we'll get to the end of this passage in Masechet Megillah, and then we'll see a very interesting other version of the story in the Midrash and Echa. In all of them, Rachel doesn't seem to know that she's also going to get to marry Yaakov. It seems like the power of the story is, right, in the story itself, we in the psukim that we saw, we have no idea about Rachel. We just know that Yaakov works for Rachel for 7 years in order to be able to marry her, and then in the end he winds up married to Leah and he's upset about it. We have no idea what's going on in Rachel's mindset. But in all of the rabbinic descriptions of the story, it seems like there's going to be an assumption that Rachel somehow knew what was going on, made an active choice to participate in the deception, and does it in a very altruistic way. And the altruism seems to come from the fact that, like, it's not just that she's willing to kind of share Yaakov with Leah, but she actually in the moment thinks that she's really giving Yaakov to Leah, right? She really thinks that she's stepping back entirely. And I think, honestly, the truth is, it's still a great act of generosity, even if what she's doing is willing to kind of share Yaakov with Leah. But I think in both, at least both of the texts that we're going to look at, the assumption is that she really thinks that she's kind of giving him up entirely, but it is, and that's kind of seen as like the greatness of her sacrifice. But in any event, right, Yaakov is kind of relying on Rachel to make herself known, and she has the power to, right? When he gives her the simanim, that means both in the Gemara and in the Midrash that we're about to see, that means that she's able to thwart her father's deception if she wants to. And then, and it seems like at first she's planning to, but then she makes an active choice not to, right? So now in the text that we were looking at, I'll share it one more time. So in the text that we were looking at in Masechet Megillah, the reason why she changes her mind is she says, Hashta mikasfa achtai. My sister will now be ashamed, or my sister will now be humiliated. And she can't tolerate that, right? She can't tolerate the thought of her sister being humiliated. And so therefore, she gives her sister these signs, and she essentially kind of chooses her sister over Yaakov, right? Because in the end, Yaakov winds up being humiliated, right? It would be humiliating for Leah to be discovered on the wedding night, but it's also humiliating for Yaakov to wake up the next morning and discover that he's not married to the woman that he wanted to marry, right? And especially given that the story here gives Rachel that agency, right? She knew beforehand that the deception was going to happen. She told Yaakov about it. Yaakov gives her the simanim over here in the Gemara, and then she chooses to hand them over, right? There's a way in which we're saying, Rachel, is deeply implicated in the deception, and she's kind of choosing to protect Leah, but she's choosing to protect Leah kind of at the expense of Yaakov. And I think there's something interesting about that, right? That even though it's a great act of kindness to Leah, it's also a betrayal of Yaakov, right? And there's a sense that, like, she feels so committed to her sister that she is kind of willing to do this. And the other part of it that I think is really interesting is that the Talmud over here is describing it as an act of tsniut, right? And it's not so clear. Here, I'll stop the share one more time for 1 second. It's not so clear what that really means for it to be an act of tsniut, right? Oh, I see Alana has asked that same question. How are her actions here considered to be modest, right? Seems sort of strange, right? You could say it's very generous for her to do this for Leah, to be willing to, you know, to kind of give up this marriage that, you know, that was intended for her in order to protect her sister. So it could be generous. It could be selfless. But how would you define it as modest? I'm curious. Does anybody have any idea why would the Talmud call this an act of tsniut?
Kind of hiding herself. You know, she puts herself behind the scenes.
Yeah, right? She's kind of holding herself back in some way. That could totally be. Well, you know what? Let's actually see to the end of the Gemara, and then I'll ask the question again. Here we go.
Could Tzniut be lost? She's lost property. Simanim are for the claiming of property.
Uh-huh.
Making herself lost property.
Oh, maybe. I like that. That makes sense too. Okay. So we know that, remember, the Gemara started off by saying in the merit of the modesty that Rachel displays, she merits having Shaul, the first king of Israel, as her descendant. And Shaul similarly has this quality of modesty that his ancestor Rachel had. And in the merit of that, he then merits having Esther, the queen, as his descendant. So let's see. So we saw Rachel's act of modesty. Why that's called modesty, we'll leave as an open question for a moment. But here we're told because of it, the fichach zachta v'yatza mimenu Shaul. So, in that merit, she now has the descendant, Shaul. Umatzniu haita b'Shaul. Well, what was the great modesty that we see with Shaul? Dichtiv v'etvar hamlucha lo higilo asher amar Shmuel. So, the moment where we see Shaul being really modest. So if we remember, the story of how Shaul becomes king is that if you remember, his father, loses some donkeys and Shaul and his attendant go out searching for his father's donkeys. They look everywhere for 3 days. They don't find the donkeys. They're about to give up and go home because Shaul says, my father's going to be more worried about us now than he is about the donkeys. But his attendant says, actually, you know what? We should go ask the Navi. Maybe the prophet will know where your donkeys are. So they decide to go to Shmuel to ask about the donkeys. When they go and they find Shmuel, Shmuel says to him, okay, first of all, don't worry about the donkeys. They've already been found. But also, God is choosing you to be the first king of Israel. And Shaul and the prophet Shmuel stay up all night talking. The prophet Shmuel gives Shaul all manner of signs that will come to be. And then Shaul leaves him, and then Shaul on his way home runs into his uncle. And when he sees his uncle, he tells his uncle all about the donkeys being found, but he kind of leaves out the main news, which is that now he's the first king of Israel, right? So we're told he tells his uncle about the donkeys, but at Dvar HaMlucha lo higilo, but he does not tell his uncle about the fact that he's been made king. And this is a sign of Shaul's modesty. And because of Shaul's great modesty, as a reward, he merits having Queen Esther as his descendant. So if we think about this Gemara for a second, Shaul's modesty seems a little bit more clear, right? He's just been made the king of Israel, but he's not bragging about that. He just kind of gives the news about the donkeys. In terms of how that relates to Rachel, it's a little bit trickier to kind of figure that part out. But I would say that maybe one way to define snoot over here in the Gemara is that you're not kind of claiming all the things that you really have coming to you, right? You're kind of holding back a little bit, right? Shaul is the first king of Israel, but he doesn't go around broadcasting that to his uncle. He kind of holds back a little bit. And maybe we could say something similar about Rachel, right? Rachel really should be marrying Yaakov, right? They've made an agreement between the two of them. He is working in order to be able to marry her. But even though she knows that really that is the thing that should be coming to her, she's willing to kind of withdraw a little bit and make space for her sister because she's concerned about her sister's feelings. And so the Gemara basically kind of ascribes a lot of agency to Rachel, right? Rachel has the power to thwart her father's deception. She chooses not to out of a sense of obligation to her sister, but it really is kind of at the expense of her husband, right? She really, you know, she protects Leah from humiliation, but she really opens Yaakov up to humiliation and even more than humiliation, right? Yaakov wants to be married to Rachel, and now he's married to Leah. I know Shelley before suggested that maybe Rachel knew all along that she would also get to marry him, but I'm not sure that she has a reason to know that, right? She might just think that now Yaakov will be married to Leah, and she'll have to marry somebody else. And it's one thing from Rachel's perspective to sort of be generous in that manner, but if that means that Yaakov is also always going to be married, not the person that he wants to be, it seems like a big thing to kind of, impose upon somebody else, right? It's one thing for her to want to be generous to Leah, but it seems a little more difficult if you imagine the story from Yaakov's perspective.
She would have thought that she couldn't marry Yaakov because you can't marry a wife's sister.
Yeah, exactly, right? If she had a sense of the way, you know, the Torah laws that were going to be given later, right? Exactly, right? The Torah eventually says right, that a man is not allowed to marry two sisters while they're both alive. So she might have thought that she was forever giving up on the possibility of a relationship with him. And it's one thing for her to make that choice, but to make that choice on behalf of Yaakov without even talking to him about it, feels like a difficult thing, especially because Yaakov's really trusting her, right? Yaakov is giving her these signs, so that way they'll together be able to make sure to find each other. And it seems like one could see that it would be very difficult from Yaakov's perspective. Annie, do you have a question, please?
I wanted to comment that I think the sisters marrying the two sisters does not apply because it's not in the land of Israel here, and we'll see later that that's one of the reasons that one of them dies before they get to the land of Israel.
Oh, that's very interesting, right? So maybe this law, that could be. I mean, in the way that Torah law is generally understood is that it's not specific to the land of Israel, but it is also the case that frequently characters in Bereshit wind up doing things that later Torah law would look askance at. So it's a little hard to know exactly how much like the mitzvot that the people of Israel are given later kind of apply to these earlier stories. And it looked like maybe Nitzi also.
Yes. You're fine. I'm just wondering, all this blaming and all, why wouldn't she assume immediately that Yaakov would feel betrayed by her?
Yeah.
I never want to see her again, or
100%, right? Right. Maybe Yaakov wouldn't even want to marry her afterwards after this kind of betrayal. Now that's a great point. So I want us to now look at this second version of this, right? Which is it's a really interesting midrash in Eicha Rabbah. So Eicha Rabbah is the set of midrashim on the Book of Lamentations, on the Book of Eicha. And the Book of Eicha itself is mostly the people of Israel saying, you know, we've sinned and this is our punishment. And maybe if we repent, God will forgive us, right? The Book of Eicha is very much accepting responsibility. But the Book of Eicha Rabbah, the Midrash of Eicha Rabbah, is actually much more kind of almost like a set of protest, right? The Book of Eicha Rabbah is about kind of pushing back against God's judgment and saying, well, God, is this really the way you had to behave to us? So in line with that kind of general approach of Eicha Rabbah, we have the following story. And I didn't include the whole midrash in the interest of time, but I'll just tell you the beginning. It begins with Yirmiyahu, the prophet Yirmiyahu, going and waking up all of our forefathers from their graves, right? He goes to Merat HaMachpelah and he wakes up Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, and he says, terrible things are going on. The people of Israel are being exiled. You have to come and plead for them. And each one of them, Avraham comes and pleads before God, and God doesn't listen to his pleas. And Yitzchak comes and pleads before God, and God doesn't listen to Yitzchak or to Yaakov. Then Yirmiyahu goes and wakes up Moshe. Moshe also pleads with God. God doesn't listen to Moshe either. And in the midst of all of this, we're told, now over here in source number 5, Be'otah sha'ah kafza Rachel imenu lifnei HaKadosh Baruch Hu. At this moment, Rachel jumps up before God. And I always like the alacrity with which she kind of jumps forward in this midrash. And she says, Ribono shel olam, Master of the world, Galui lefanecha she'Yaakov avdecha ahavani ahava yetera. She says, God, it is clearly known before you that your servant Yaakov loved me with an excessive love. V'avad bishvili la'aba sheva shanim. He loved me so much that he worked in order to be married to me for my father. He worked for my father in order to marry me for 7 years. U'kishishlimu otan sheva shanim. When those 7 years were up, v'higiyaz man nisui labali, and it was time for me to marry my husband. Ya'atz avi lahachlifeni lebaali bishvil achoti. My father planned to switch me and my sister. V'hukshe alai hadavar ad ma'od. And she says, the matter was very difficult for me. Now, I like this line in the Midrash because the truth is, we didn't know. In the Talmud doesn't talk about it being difficult for Rachel. It just talks about the fact that, like, she knew it was going to happen and she wanted to, she tells Yaakov and they come up with a plan. But here we're told, she knew what was going to happen, and it was very hard for her because she really wants to marry Yaakov in this midrash. And she says, it was very hard for me, ki no da'ali ha'itza, because I knew about my father's plan, and I knew he was going to do this, and it was very difficult. So what did I do? Hodati lebali. So I told my husband. Now, I like the fact also that she describes Yaakov as her husband, even though they're not married yet, right? Because, you know, she feels like their bond is so strong. So she says, I told my husband about this plan. Umasarti lo siman sheyakir beni ubein achoti. And I gave him a sign so that he would recognize the difference between me and my sister. Now you'll notice also in the source that we saw before, in source number 4 in the Talmud, if you remember, Yaakov is the one who gives Rachel the sign. But here Rachel is totally the one in charge, right? She's the one who knows about the plan. She's the one who comes up with a different plan to thwart her father's plan. And she's the one who thinks of the idea of giving her husband a sign, right? In this story, Rachel is totally in charge of everything. So she says, I gave him a sign, Sheyakir beni ubein achoti, kedei shelo yuchal avi lahachlifeni, because I didn't want my father to be able to switch me. I really wanted to marry Yaakov, and I was going to make sure it happened. And then she says, ulacharkei nichamti batzmi, but afterwards, I thought about it again, and I regretted having done this. V'savalti etavati, and I was able to swallow my desire. V'richamti al achoti shelo tetzei lecherpa. And I had a lot of mercy on my sister because I didn't want her to be humiliated. Ula erev chalfu achoti lebali bishvili. And so that night, on the wedding night, they switched my sister for me. Umasarti laachoti kol asimanim shemasarti lebali. Michal says, I decided to give my sister all of those signs that I gave my husband, right? Whatever those signs were, I gave them to my sister. Kedei sheyehe savur shehi Rachel, because I really wanted him to think that she was me, right? Even though I was deceiving my husband, I wanted to protect my sister. And so I gave her all those signs. And now the Midrash takes it a step further and adds in a crazy detail. The lo'od, not only did I give her all the signs, Ela shenichnasti tachat hamita sheya shokev machoti. I actually went into their room and I lay there underneath the bed in which he was lying with my sister. V'haya medaberima, he would speak with her. V'hi shoteket, and she would be silent. V'ani meshivato al kol davar v'davar, and I would answer him about everything that he said. Kedei shelo yakir lekol achoti, because I didn't want him to recognize the voice of my sister, right? This seems to be the problem, right? The problem with this story is that we assume that Yaakov knows Rachel's voice. And if he knows Rachel's voice, how could he not know that he's in bed with Leah, right? So Radak says, well, he just must not have spoken to her very much. He didn't really know her voice, or he's not really hearing her voice that night. That's one possibility. The other possibility, though, is that he does know her voice, right? Whatever signs there are, nothing is, right? Think about any person you know, right? Any person you know well, all they need to do is say something to you and you know that it's them, right? So the Midrash says, obviously he knows Rachel's voice and Rachel knows that he knows her voice. And so therefore, it must be then that she has to come up with some sort of plan for him not recognizing that it's not her voice. So what does she do?
Call Yaakov, right?
Exactly, right? Yitzchak, who can't see at all, is able to recognize Yaakov's voice and says, Hakol Kol Yaakov, exactly. So obviously, if you know a person, you know their voice. And so she says, I knew that he would know my voice. And so therefore, I did this ultimate thing. I was willing to lie under their bed on my wedding night. And as he is exchanging intimacies with Leah, I respond to him. So that way he hears my voice and not my sister's voice. Vigamalti chesed ima. And Rachel now says to God, look, I did this act of mercy for my sister, v'lo kineti ba, and I wasn't jealous of her, v'lo hotziti alecherpa, and I didn't allow her to be taken out and shamed. Uma anish ani basar v'dam afar v'efer. And Rachel now turns to God and she says, look, I'm just flesh and blood. I'm just dust and ashes. And still, lo kineti latzara sheli. I was not jealous of my rival wife, right? I was willing to have Leah marry my husband. I didn't allow her to be taken out and disgraced and shamed. And now Rachel turns to God and says, Vata melechai v'kayam rachaman. Rachel says, look, God, you're an eternal living king. Mipnei ma kineta lavodazara she'en b'mamash. Rachel says, look, if I'm just flesh and blood, dust and ashes. If I was able to swallow my jealousy out of concern for my sister, God, why can't you swallow your jealousy, right? Why are you so jealous of idols, she'ein b'mamash, right? They're not even real, right? My sister, she was a real woman, right? She, you know, that's a real difficulty, but I was willing to swallow my jealousy of my sister. God, can't you swallow your jealousy of the idols? They're not even real anyway. And because the people of Israel have worshipped the idols, higleta banai, you've now exiled my children, v'nehargu b'charev, they've been killed with a sword, v'asu oivim bam kirtzonam, their enemies have done to them whatever they wanted, right? God, what's going on here? If I am able to swallow my jealousy, you should be able to swallow your jealousy, right? You don't, just because you're jealous doesn't mean you need to act on it. If I am just a human being, if I was able to do that, certainly you should be able to. And we're told, miyad nitgalgalu rachamav shel HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So immediately God's mercy is aroused. V'amar bishvilech Rachel ani machzir et Yisrael imkomam. And God says, for your sake, Rachel, I will bring Israel back. I wasn't willing to do it for the sake of Avraham, Yitzchak, Yaakov, and Moshe, but for your sake, Rachel, I will bring Israel back to their land. Hahu detema, as the verse in Yirmiyahu says, Ko amar Hashem kol berama nishma. God says, a voice was heard on high. Nehi b'chi tamurim Rachel mevakal baneha. It's a voice kind of bitterly crying. It's Rachel crying for her children. Me'ana lihi nachem al baneha ki einenu. She is refusing to be comforted for her children because they are not here. And God responds to her and says, Mini kolech mi bechi. Keep your voice from crying, ve'naich midima, and your eyes from tearing, ki yesh sachar lipi'ulatech, because there is reward for what you have done. And the reward for what you have done over here seems to be either for this great argument that you were able to make right now to God, or maybe even for your initial pi'ula, your initial action in being willing to sort of swallow your jealousy to protect Leah. Right, there will be hope for the future. I will return. I will make sure that your children return to their land. Okay, so I think a couple of things are very interesting about this midrash. Right, one is that it kind of takes the story in the Gemara and it kind of intensifies it, right? Like here we hear the whole story specifically from Rachel's perspective, right? She's the one speaking to God. She makes it clear that it's very difficult for her to be, you know, to kind of know that Leah is going to be switched for her. She really doesn't want it to happen. She's the one who works to prevent it from being happening, from happening. And then at the last minute, she changes her mind, right? She changes her mind. And the reason that she changes her mind, both in the Midrash and Eicha Rabbah, and the Gemara and Megillah, is that she feels a sense of loyalty to her sister. She really doesn't want her sister to be shamed. And so she basically participates in this deception in order to protect her sister. In the Gemara, she participates in the deception by giving to her sister the signs that Yaakov gave her. And in the Midrash and Eicha Rabbah, it actually goes much further, right? She, first of all, is the one who comes up with the idea of the signs. She gives them to, she gives Yaakov signs so that he can identify her. And then she gives those same signs to Leah so that Leah can impersonate her. And then in that really wild moment, she's actually there lying under their bed, whispering back to him so that he thinks that it's her, right? She's very deeply involved in the deception. And I think it's interesting that in both the passage in the Talmud and in the Midrash, instead of saying, oh, Rachel, she really betrayed Yaakov here, this is really not good behavior, instead, in both cases, it's seen as an act of it's a very meritorious act, right? It's something that is really praiseworthy, right? In the Talmud, we say, oh, because Rachel did this, she merits having, you know, Shaul, the first king of Israel, as her descendant. And in Eicha, because Rachel did this, she's able to persuade God to forgive the people of Israel in the future. So there's a sense that her action in terms of her sister is seen as being very praiseworthy. And I think it's interesting that both stories, both the one in the Talmud and the one in Eicha Rabbah, kind of elide the impact on Yaakov. And I'm curious what people think about that, right? Why do you think we're only looking at it from the perspective of how kind she's being to Leah, and we're not looking at it from the perspective of Yaakov? So what do you think that is about?
Well, I think perhaps because of Yaakov's deception of Isaac,
mm-hmm.
that this was something that was coming to him in a sense, mm-hmm. that maybe this is payback, you know, in a way.
Yeah. Got exactly. So in some sort of global sense, right, there's a sense that Yaakov in last week's Parsha, Yaakov deceives his brother, his father, rather, right? His father wants to choose his brother Esav, and Yaakov tricks him into choosing him. And so here, Yaakov himself is tricked, right? Yaakov wants to choose Rachel, and he's sort of tricked into choosing Leah. And so maybe, you know, from like the overall perspective, we feel like this is something that Yaakov deserves. But it still seems to me that like within their relationship, right, there seems like there's something very difficult about that. And I think the reason why I find the question particularly interesting is that it's a difficulty that only really comes about because of the agency that both the Talmud and the Midrash ascribe to Rachel, right? When we just looked at the verses, in the verses, there's no reason for Yaakov to be angry at Rachel, because in the verses, doesn't seem like Rachel has any choice about it, right? Her father presents, you know, Leah to Yaakov instead of Rachel. It doesn't seem like Rachel can do anything about it. And so, of course, there's no reason to be angry at Rachel in the Psukim, because what could she do anyway? But in both the Talmud and in Eicha Rabbah, there's a sense that Rachel, that the deception couldn't have happened unless Rachel was really a part of it, right? And that like she has the ability to sort of stop the deception. And instead of stopping it, she actively helps it to happen, right? By giving the signs to Leah, by hiding under the bed. And that instead of saying, wow, look at Rachel, she's so deceitful, just like her father, instead we say, wow, look what a great thing Rachel is doing. And again, I'm curious, right? What do you think that's about, right? Why choose to tell the story in that way?
Well, it seems to me that in all the stories of Yaakov and his wives, Yaakov is an extremely passive character.
Mm-hmm.
And it's his wives who sort of move him like a chess piece. And they are the active people in it. You know, mm-hmm. you take him for the night, I'll give you him. He's greeted from the fields. I rented you. I did this. I did that. And he never says a word. Mm-hmm. He only speaks in anger in response to something that Rachel says. Mm-hmm. He never even speaks up when Leia says anything. So I think the Midrash is also picking up on that, that here is another situation where both Rachel, that Rachel is manipulating the, you know, the pieces with the cards that she's given. Mm-hmm. I also think, and I wanted to say this before, Rachel has grown up in this house and knows very well her father's personality. Mm-hmm. So she knew that things are not as what they seem. No matter what agreement Yaakov thinks he signed on to, Rachel knows very well that whatever Lavan had wanted to occur mm-hmm. is what's going to really be in the end.
Mm-hmm.
And that he's going to figure it out, whatever it is. And she knows that that's the reality. Yaakov might not, he hasn't experienced life in Lavan's house.
Mm-hmm.
Rachel has experienced it for far longer.
Yeah, yeah, I think that's such an interesting aspect of it, right? Because if Rachel was just resigned, right, like, oh, what can I do? My father's going to do this. There's nothing I can do about it. Then I think it's a different story, and it's a story that is much more kind of, it's a much easier story in terms of Rachel and Yaakov, if that's the way that it is, right? If it's just that Lavan all along was going to do what he was going to do, there's really nothing Rachel can do about it, then we don't blame, you know, there's nothing to blame Rachel about in terms of her relationship with Yaakov. What was she supposed to do? You know, her father had all of this power. She couldn't really help it. But I think that, like, there's something very interesting about giving Rachel all of this agency, which then allows us to say, look how kind she's being to her sister. But the flip side of that is kind of this betrayal of Yaakov that we then have to sort of figure out what to do with. And I think that that notion of Yaakov being sort of almost kind of resigned to whatever the women in his life are doing is an interesting perspective on it, right? Maybe, you know, is that why he's not so angry at her? Is he just so in love with her? Does he have a sense that she's not doing this in a selfish way, but she wants to protect her sister. So maybe Yaakov kind of can sympathize with that, right? It feels to me like a very interesting sort of,
He also did that last week. His mother set him up.
It's a great point. Okay. There's somebody who has their hand raised. The number is 973, but I don't know your name. I'm sorry. But if 973 wants to ask their question, that would be great.
There wouldn't be 12 tribes if Rachel hadn't engaged in the deception.
Well, it's honestly, it's kind of hard to know, right? It's hard to know if, like, you know, maybe she would have had all 12 tribes. It's always hard to know.
She didn't. She was almost barren. She had real problems, and Leah didn't. So
yeah.
It was a great choice that Lavan made.
Okay, that could be.
Isn't it possible all later on Rachel is going to steal the trafim and Yaakov didn't even know about that? So she's an independent actress, I should say.
Yeah, totally. Right. I mean, that was the point that somebody just made before, right? That Rachel and Leah seem to be kind of very much kind of doing, you know, kind of acting independently, and Yaakov kind of, you know, more or less seems resigned to what they do. I wanted to suggest one other thing, maybe because I see that we don't have so much more time, and then I'll be so happy to take a few more comments. But I think if we were to kind of get back to our original question that we started with, which is how could this deception have happened, right? How is it possible that Yaakov could have loved Rachel for 7 years, lived with her in the same household, and somehow not known that he was with her, right? So one possibility is something about Yaakov, right? He's so very modest. He just doesn't really talk to Rachel. He can't recognize her voice. That's why he doesn't. The other possibility is that, no, he would have known that it was Rachel, but Rachel herself is deeply involved in the deception herself, right? The deception couldn't have happened unless Rachel was somehow, you know, an actor in it. And the reason why Rachel is part of the deception is not for any nefarious reason, but because of her great altruism and wanting to protect her sister, right? So that's another possibility. The other possibility, which I think the Midrash and the Talmud are trying to avoid, is that maybe Yaakov doesn't know that it's Rachel, because maybe he doesn't really know Rachel that well, right? Even though he's loved her for 7 years and like lived in the same household, right? Sometimes, right, people kind of love a particular idea that they have in their head about a person more than they love the actual person, right? And it could be that Yaakov has kind of built up an image in his head of who Rachel is that might not necessarily cohere with who she actually is, right? And that kind of fits with the comment that somebody just made before about stealing the trafim, right? Remember, Yaakov, it doesn't occur to him that Rachel could have possibly stolen the trafim. That's why he makes that very intense statement of whoever stole them will die, right? It never occurs to him that she would be capable of that. So it could, right? Another possibility could be that maybe Rachel doesn't, you know, maybe Yaakov doesn't know that's Rachel because maybe the person who he's loved is not necessarily, doesn't really fit neatly onto the person that she actually is. Maybe that's why he doesn't know who it is. But these sources don't want to see it that way, right? They don't want to say that, like, the reason why Yaakov doesn't know her is because he, you know, the reason why Yaakov can't recognize her, it's not because he doesn't really know her, but it's because she is somehow helping to pull the wool over his eyes. And she does it only, you know, for the best possible intention, which is to protect her sister. Now, the other thing that's also a little bit funny about that is that in almost every other story about Rachel and Leah, it doesn't seem like they would go to great lengths to protect each other. In fact, they often seem to be very much competing with one another, right? They have these children, they name them for the competition with each other, and so forth. There's something interesting also about the Midrash and the Gemara kind of seeing this moment of great altruism of Rachel doing this in order to protect Leah, which also kind of seems at odds with the relationship that happens afterwards. Now, it doesn't mean that it couldn't be, right? Sometimes people can be very generous one moment and then afterwards have difficulty. That could be. But I think that my sense is that the Talmud and the Midrash are almost reading the story against the grain in order to produce a particular account of Rachel is A, having a lot of agency, and B, really kind of looking out for her sister, right? Really wanting to kind of protect her sister. And that's why, you know, kind of this great betrayal of Yaakov is pulled off. And that Yaakov doesn't see it as Rachel betraying him. He sees it as Lavan betraying him, right? He doesn't seem to be angry with Rachel about this. He also doesn't seem to be angry with Leah about this. He basically, you know, immediately goes to Lavan and complains. Lavan kind of brushes him off and says, this is just the way we do things here. Don't worry, you can also marry Rachel. I think it's interesting to kind of see the particular version of the story that the Midrash and the Gemara are presenting. Okay, so I see that it's 9:30. I'm not going anywhere, so I'm so happy to entertain other people's comments and thoughts. But if anybody needs to leave, they feel like they can.
I would like to.
Oh, sorry. Please.
How about Rachel Lavan was the father, and he must have been a strict father. Maybe she was scared of him.
Maybe Rachel was scared. Exactly. That's what I was saying. If we just look at the psukim, it could totally just be that, you know, in this patriarchal society, Rachel had no power. She had no agency. Her father switched her sister for her. What could she do about it? You know, we can't blame Rachel. We can't blame Leah. It's all about Lavan. That's really the very straightforward reading that you would get from the verses, right? And that's why it's interesting that the rabbinic texts instead introduce this whole layer of a lot of agency on the part of Rachel, even though in the story, right, in the actual verses, we don't really see it in this part of the story. Ruth, please, what is your comment?
Yes, thank you. So I have always wondered about these midrashim because they seem to be, as you say, they're working against the story. And the argument that they present, that Rachel is worried about her sister being embarrassed, she's going to be embarrassed no matter what she does the next morning. When Yaakov finds out that she is Leah, then the embarrassment is really going to come out. Not that night. The night, all Rachel does is put off the embarrassment. But I think that when you look at the entire construction of the Midrash, it is fantastic and it doesn't make sense. Mm-hmm. But if you But and I just tonight it occurred to me that this could be my suggestion. The rabbis are starting from Rachel Mivaka Abaneha. That's where they're starting. And they want to construct something that explains that. Like what did Rachel do that, that makes her prayer be the one that God's going to listen to? And so they backtrack and create a scenario, a thing that would somehow or other, on the flimsiest of bases, would create this sense of so that they can say she comes to God and says, I allowed my sister to marry my husband, and now I took, it's like, you know, taking the tzara into my house. Mm-hmm. The only way that works is if they can construct a story about how Leah marries Yaakov first. Because otherwise it doesn't make sense.
So Ruth, I think that's a really interesting point, but I would maybe say that if you just wanted to talk about like Rachel crying for her children, you could say Rachel is like one of the mothers who we see most actively really wanting a child, right? Out of everyone, right? She's the one we hear, you know, sort of saying, you know, Havali bani mim ayin meta anochi, right? Give me children, otherwise I will die. The moment she has a child, she immediately hopes for another one. So it wouldn't be unusual to say that the reason why she's crying for her children is that she's the woman most associated with generally crying for children, right? And so I think it's interesting that the rabbis, you could have had just that, like, you know, that could have just been the end of the story, but instead they kind of construct this whole other tale where, like, actually what she's doing is not just crying for her children, but really challenging God to swallow God's jealousy, just like she did. It's very interesting. I mean, and one of the other reasons I think why it's so interesting is that if you look at the kina that's based on this midrash, there's a famous kina that's recited on Tisha B'Av that's based specifically on this midrash. The kina begins with the phrase "Az b'haloch Yirmiyahu al kivrei avot," begins like with Yirmiyahu waking up all the ancestors and so forth. In that kina, the thing that persuades God to have mercy on the people of Israel is not Rachel's argument, but it's Rachel and Leah and Bilhah and Zilpah all come and just cry before God, and their tears move God. And so it's interesting, they're the fathers, Avraham, Yitzchak, Yaakov, and Moshe, they all make like logical arguments, and God rejects that. And in the kina, it's the tears of the mothers that persuade God. So the kina kind of does away with Rachel's argument and just kind of holds on to the idea of Rachel crying as being persuasive. But the midrash kind of really gives her this whole other kind of, you know, this whole other story that is not in the psukim, and that I think is really interesting, because I think it's a way of kind of giving Rachel, you know, just more power and more agency than she seems to have in the story itself, and kind of makes her into this very complicated character, right? Who can like simultaneously be really sad and really jealous, but also really protective of her sister, right? She just becomes like a much more complicated character in the midrash.
With the way that there are,
I don't buy it because I think the argument in Midrash Eicha is that she's the only one who can come and say, God, you have to tolerate Avodah Zarah because I did, and in order for her to make that argument, there has to be this backstory.
Oh, 100%. That I totally agree with, but I'm just saying that the pasuk where she's crying for her children in Yirmiyahu, it could just be her crying, right? Like the midrash creates this great argument that she's making based on the story, 100%.
It's interesting that she does not tolerate Avodah Zarah. She's the one who hides the terafim.
Right, it's true. Like exactly what she's doing with the terafim is, you know, the rabbis have lots of opinions about.
Pshat is that she's going against Avodah Zarah. And against what the Midrash says.
Well, I think the pshat is probably that she wants the trafim, right? No. That's why she took them. But I know that there are
Midrash
who takes them to prevent her father from worshipping them. But probably the pshat is that like she herself maybe feels connected to these trafim in some manner. And
do we need to consider the story of the Dudaim between the two sisters and their relationship?
I mean, exactly, right? If you think about the story of the Dudaim, there they don't seem to be very protective of one another, right? Leah has all these children. She knows her sister is dying for a child, and her sister thinks that the Judaim could help her. And instead, instead of giving them to Rachel, she says, right, Hama'at kachtech et ishti, right? Isn't it enough that you took my husband? Do you also want to take my son's Judaim? And Rachel has to say to her, like, okay, fine. If you give me the Judaim, you can have the husband, right? So it doesn't seem like there's a lot of grace and generosity there in that story, right? And I think we'd have to say, you know, if we took, you know, the version of the relationship between Rachel and Leah that it's being described here in these sources, we'd have to say, like, yeah, there was an earlier moment of great generosity, and then, you know, sometimes in the course of living, like, also things get difficult. And just because one is, I mean, especially in relationships with close family members, right? You can have a time of intense generosity and also a time of intense jealousy. And like, there's one doesn't cancel the other one out, right? Like, you know, both can kind of coexist and often do in most people's actual relationships.
And one was before they actually started to live as husband and wife.
Yeah.
Yeah. One was when it really got sticky.
Yeah, yeah, totally true. Totally true.
And it's also important that each of these stories comes from a different time, comes from a different source, and very well can have been generated to solve a particular point or make a particular point. And so the fact that it rubs a little bit wrong compared to another story is immaterial.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that could also totally be. I see that there's a point here that was written by 973, whose name I don't know. Sorry.
That's me, Larry. My name is Larry.
Oh, great. Yeah, Larry makes a great point, right? You said that you would posit that Rachel feared that if Leah was discovered and embarrassed by Yaakov, then Lavan would not have allowed Yaakov to marry Rachel, right? Maybe Rachel is worried that if she were to... Well, see, that's interesting. I think that, like, it's not that Leah would be discovered... Huh, that's a good point. I guess if Leah was discovered, that would just mean that marriage wouldn't happen, but it wouldn't necessarily mean that Yaakov would get to marry Rachel.
I think Laban would have still said, we marry our oldest first here, and you embarrass my oldest. I don't want you in my family. You're not marrying Rachel.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't know what else the signs would have accomplished. It wouldn't have accomplished that he's going to marry Rachel. It only would have embarrassed Leah.
Yeah,
given how crafty and how deceitful and how mercenary Lavan is, he would have had his daughters marry Jacob anyway, because as he says, he sees that because of Jacob, he's getting rich. So what's the problem? You know, one girl or another girl? You know, it's they're you know, disposable.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's interesting. They're, you know, Rachel and Leah are very resentful of their father, right? In the end, when Yaakov consults with them about leaving, they say, like, basically, he's treated us like strangers. He's taken all of our property, right? So they're very resentful of their father. They don't think that they're being treated well by their father at all. And I think partly that has to do with the fact that he is kind of, you know, both demanding that Yaakov work for them for so long, and then even after the 14 years are up, when Yaakov keeps when Lavan keeps changing Yaakov's salary, right? I think they have the sense that, like, their father is trying to, like, cheat them out of property that they, you know, that they and their children need. So they're very resentful of their father, and probably kind of stemming from this initial trickery also, right? The sense that Yaakov is kind of, sorry, that Lavan is sort of using them as a way to, you know, to get more money or to get more stuff.
Definitely. Is there any commentary as to why, in the middle of this amazingly dramatic story, we have to learn that Lavan gave a concubine? Like, why couldn't that wait till this was all over? Like, does it have anything to do really with the main arc of the story?
I think that's a really interesting question. I believe that there's a midrash that suggests that Zilpah and Bilhah were also daughters of Lavan, but they were daughters that Lavan had with either concubines or with slaves. And so I wonder if maybe what that midrash is suggesting is that the reason why we're told about it over here is that Lavan basically treats all of his daughters as, you know, as... Uh-huh. as property in some manner, right? He gives Gilpat to Leah, but he's also treating Leah as like, you know, not really as a person also. He's also kind of treating her as an object to sort of be moved around to suit his own goals. So that might be like the reason why the Midrash suggests that. Because I think you're right. Otherwise, the only other reason I can think of other than that is that later on when Leah suddenly offers Zilpah up as a concubine to Yaakov, like, we want to know where she came from. And so, but
that's a very good point. The point is that Zilpah is dropped into the story at this place because it's a very innocuous place to put her.
Yeah. As
to be there when it's necessary for her to become, a main character. Point is that if Zilpah is introduced later on, there's a question: why did he wait so long to give Zilpah to his daughter? This way, it's a standard, wedding present, and she's available.
Yeah, and I think the story of Bilhah and Zilpah is really interesting because it also kind of reflects back on the Sarah and Hagar story, right? If we didn't hear about Bilhah and Zilpah, we would have just thought, like, what was Sarah thinking? Like, what a terrible plan to, like, introduce this kind of other woman into your marriage. Of course it was going to be a disaster. But then when we see, the Bilhah and Zilpah part of the story, it seems to be okay for them, right? You know, like, it's a way of having more children. You know, there's no great drama involved. I mean, unfortunately, we never really hear about Bilhah and Zilpah being asked whether or not they want to be surrogates. But, it at least doesn't seem to cause any sort of ruptures in the family. There's no great jealousy because of them. And it kind of gives us a sense that, like, Sarah wasn't crazy to think about, maybe this would have been a good way to have another child with Avraham if she herself couldn't. But of course, with the Hagar story, it does not play out drama free way.
The question comes up: did any of these actors, Jacob or the four wives, did they know that the whole point was to have 12 tribes?
I think it really depends. Certainly the Midrash assumes that, right? The Midrashim assume that everybody knows that there are going to be 12 tribes. And that's why when Leah is pregnant for the seventh time, she says, oh no, if I have another son now, then that means Rachel will only have one son. And then she prays and her son becomes a daughter, right? So there's a sense in those stories in those Midrashim that like, everyone is aware that there are going to be 12 children. And the question is just like, how are they all going to be sort of apportioned? Like who's going to have which ones? But, I think if you look at the psukim, there's not a particular sense of that, right? There's not even a sense. I mean, I think what's so interesting about the psukim is that there's not a sense at all in the psukim that Yaakov is particularly invested in having 12 children, right? The only thing we know that Yaakov really wants is he really wants to marry Rachel. And he'd really like to make some money to support his family, right? But we don't ever hear him. He doesn't get involved in this question of who's having children, right? He's kind of, he'll go wherever they send him, right? Rachel is the woman that he wants to be with. And he's kind of happy to have more children, but it doesn't seem like we never hear him expressing any particular, like, urgency about having children, right? Rachel is very urgent about having children, right? She's the one who says to Yaakov, give me children, otherwise I'll die. And his response is like, it's not within my power, right? It's up to God, right? I can't really do anything about this.
You used the word surrogates. Mm-hmm. They were actually, as you said, surrogates.
Yeah, kind of. That is true.
What I don't understand is in the beginning you talked about because of the merit of Rachel, she gets Shaul, and because of the merit of, is it Shaul, you get Esther. Well, if Leah has so much merit and is so wonderful that she doesn't want her sister to only have one son instead of at least the same amount as the concubines, she gets a daughter, Dina, who gets raped by Shechem. This doesn't seem to be very meritorious. It doesn't seem to fit in with the rest of this. Sometimes I just don't know. Things happen. God knows why they happen. We don't. We can come up with all the midrashim or all the pretty things that we want, but we don't really have an answer.
Right. Although, Shelley, I would say that there's a great midrash that I love about when we're told that God blesses Avraham with everything, right? V'Hashem berachat Avraham bakol. One opinion there is what that means is that Avraham has a daughter, because there is no greater blessing than having a daughter. Like, how could Avraham be blessed with everything if he doesn't have a daughter? So we could say that, you know, Dina's reward is that she's the only one who gets to have a daughter. And, you know, that's a pretty fantastic thing to have. So I don't know. I would read it that way. If we want
to. I suggest a perspective, and I couldn't unmute if you don't mind, a different one, because I found myself from being reminded of a wonderful share by Aviva Zornberg years mm-hmm. ago. I can't remember all the many, many intricate details, but Leah actually was the one who was meant to be. I think Rachel was an agent, maybe unwittingly, but it turns out that Leah is the mother of the Shvatim, and Rachel plays a supportive role. And I think that's maybe there's also we resonate with Rachel because she is a tragic heroine, whichever way you look at it.
Mm-hmm.
She may not have, you know, it reminds me of what Yosef said to the brothers eventually. You did what you did, but it had to turn out this way. So mm-hmm. I think that's, we can try to figure out this way, but the way you see it come forward, despite the best plans, this is what has to happen. Leah, Yaakov, in whichever way came to terms with it,
yeah.
and she had to die. I heard that midrash that I was, she died because, right, they're not supposed to be two wives when you arrive to Eretz Yisrael or something like that. So I'm just trying to say that she does resonate with, no matter which way you look at it, she is beloved because
I think something else that's also very clear in the psukim is that whatever we want to say about kind of who was meant to be Yaakov's wife and the mother of his children and so forth, it's clear from the psukim that for Yaakov, there's really only Rachel. And one of the ways that we know that is that there's this really powerful moment at the beginning of Parshat Vayigash when Yehuda...
Yehuda speaks.
Right. When he comes to speak with the viceroy, who is Yosef, but maybe Yehuda doesn't know that yet, what he says when he's describing his father's words, he says, you know that shtayim yaldali ishti. You know that I had one wife and two sons. One of those sons is gone. The only son that I have left is Binyamin. And there's something really powerful about Yehuda saying, I know that in my father's mind, he really only has one wife and two sons. It's not that he doesn't know that the rest of us are here. It's not that he wasn't also married to Leah. All of that is true. But I think you get the sense that Yaakov, Rachel is the one that he chose. Rachel is the one that he loved. And like in his mind, she was his wife. And Yehuda, who's not from that marriage, right, is able to see that and kind of is able to say that, right? Yehuda is able to kind of, I think that's a real act of generosity, right? It's almost like the parallel of Rachel's act over here, right? Mm-hmm. What Yehuda is saying there is, I love my father enough that I'm willing to kind of give up myself as a slave to protect my father's more chosen son, Binyamin. It feels like that's an echo of Rachel over here protecting her sister Leah. So I think there's a way in which in the verses, right, it's always for Yaakov, it's always about Rachel. Whatever we want to say about ultimately what his destiny is and who is meant to be the mother of his children and so forth, from within the psukim, the storyline itself, I think, mm-hmm. it's clear that Yaakov, you know, for Yaakov, it kind of starts and ends with Rachel. Okay, probably, Jay, should we be ending? I don't want to keep people here for too long.
I was actually just writing to you privately if we should, you know, if you want to keep going or not. I feel on the one mm-hmm. hand, you're eager to answer questions, but I think it is late. So I think it is a good idea. And we'll leave continued another time. People can email, leave the discussion. So I want to thank you for the shiur, of course, the shiur, and for your eagerness and staying on much longer to answer
absolutely.
All the questions.
Absolutely. Sure.
Thank you very much.
Beautiful.
We look forward to learning with you in the future. Yeah. And thank you.
Sure thing.
Tomorrow morning, my ongoing shiur on the Siddur at 9:30, Rabbi Liebtag on Sunday morning. Someone who's asking me privately, will please God, we'll be publishing our Hanukkah schedule before we have a few classes, you know, especially for Hanukkah, where class going on. And of course, our winter schedule beginning in 2023. But anyway, so I want to be on the lookout. But in the meantime, our regular Shiurim, of course, are continuing next week, and we hope to see you soon. And Wendy, be well, and I'm glad you're all recovered, or for sure you're recovered enough to teach Torah. So that's, you know, an important level. So thank you very much. Okay, everybody. Bye. Okay, bye-bye.
Have a good Shabbos. Thank you.
Shabbos, bye-bye.
Shabbat shalom.